There had never been a reclaimed state of Wyoming, or a restored United States for that matter, except in the imagination of an itinerant, dark age con artist doing his best to survive in a deadly and suspicious world. Mrs. Thompson was one of the rare folks Gordon had met since the war who still saw with her eyes and thought with a logical mind. The illusion Gordon had created, at first by accident and later in desperation, had meant nothing to her. She had liked Gordon for himself and shown him charity without having to be coaxed by a myth. He was writing the letter in this convoluted way, filled with references to things that never were, for eyes other than hers. The mail would change hands many times along the route he had set up before finally reaching Pine View. But Mrs. Thompson would read between the lines, and she wouldn't tell on him. Gordon was sure of that. He only hoped she could contain her laughter. This part of the Coast Fork is pretty peaceful these days. The communities have even started trading with each other in a modest fashion, overcoming the old fear of war plagues and survivalists. They're eager for news of the outside world. That's not to say all is placid. They tell me the Rogue River country south of Roseburg is still totally lawless. Nathan Holm country. So I'm headed northward toward Eugene. It's the direction most of the letters I'm carrying are addressed anyway. Deep in his saddlebag under the bundled letters he had accepted from excited, grateful people all along his way was the one Abby had given him. Gordon would try to see it delivered, whatever eventually happened to all the others. Now I must go. Perhaps someday soon a letter from you and my other dear friends will catch up with me. Until then, please give my love to Abby and Michael and all. At least as much as anywhere, the restored United States of America is alive and well in beautiful Pine View. Yours sincerely, Gordon K. That last remark might be a little dangerous, but Gordon had to include it, if only to show Mrs. Thompson he wasn't completely caught up by his own hoax, the scam that he hoped would get him safely across the almost lawless countryside to what? After all these years, Gordon still wasn't sure what it was he was looking for. Perhaps only someone, somewhere, who was taking responsibility, who was trying to do something about the Dark Age. He shook his head. After all these years, the dream would not quite die. He folded the letter into an old envelope, dribbled wax from a candle, and pressed it with a seal salvaged from the Oak Ridge post office. The letter went atop the progress report he had labored over earlier, a tissue of fantasy addressed to officials of a make-believe government. Next to the packet lay his postman's cap. The lamplight flickered in the brass image of a Pony Express rider, Gordon's silent companion and mentor for months now. Gordon had stumbled onto his new survival plan by quirk and coincidence. But now, in town after town, people fell over themselves to believe, especially when he actually delivered letters from places he had already visited. After all these years, it seemed people still longed forlornly for a lost, shiny age, an era of cleanliness and order, and a great nation now lost. The longing overwhelmed their hard-won skepticism like a spring thaw cracking the icy crust over a stream. Gordon quashed a threatening sense of shame. No one alive was guiltless after the last 17 years. And his scam actually seemed to do a little good in the towns he passed through, in exchange for supplies and a place to rest. He sold hope. One did what one had to do. There were 2 sharp raps on the door. Gordon called, "Come!" Johnny Stevens, the newly appointed assistant postmaster of Cottage Grove, poked his head in. Johnny's boyish face bore a barely sprouted fuzz of almost blonde beard, but his lanky legs promised a great cross-country stride, and he was reputed to be a dead shot. Who could tell? The lad might even deliver the mail.
Sir?
Johnny was obviously reluctant to interrupt important business.
It's 8 o'clock. You remember that the mayor wanted to have a beer with you in the pub, since it's your last night here in town?
Gordon stood up.
Right, Johnny. Thanks.
He grabbed his cap and jacket, then scooped up the phony report and the letter to Mrs. Thompson.
Here you are, then. These are official packets for your first run over to Culp Creek.
Ruth Marshall is postmistress there. She'll be expecting somebody. Her folk will treat you well. Johnny took the envelopes as if they were made of butterflies' wings.
I'll protect them with my life, sir.
The youth's eyes shone with pride and a fierce determination not to let Gordon down.
You'll do no such thing, Gordon snapped.
The last thing he wanted was for a 16-year-old to get hurt protecting a chimera.
You'll use common sense, like I told you.
Johnny swallowed and nodded, but Gordon wasn't at all sure he understood. Of course, the boy would probably just have an exciting adventure, following the forest paths farther than anyone from his village had traveled in over a decade, coming back a hero with tales to tell. There were still a few loner survivalists in those hills, but this far north of the Rogue River country, the odds were Johnny'd make it to Culp Creek and back just fine. Gordon almost had himself convinced. He exhaled and gripped the young man's shoulder.
Your country doesn't need you to die for her, Johnny, but to live and serve her another day. Can you remember that?
Yes, sir.
The lad nodded seriously.
I understand.
Gordon turned to blow out the candles. Johnny must have been rummaging in the ruins of Cottage Grove's old post office, for out in the hall, Gordon noticed the boy's homespun shirt now bore a proud U.S. mail patch on the shoulder. The colors still bright after almost 20 years.
I've already got 10 letters from people here in Cottage Grove and nearby farms, Johnny said. I don't think most of them even know anybody back east, but they're writing anyway for the excitement of it and in hopes somebody will write back.
So at least Gordon's visit had gotten people to practice their literacy skills a little. That was worth a few nights' food and lodging. You warn them that east of Pine View the route is slow yet and not guaranteed at all?
Sure. They don't care.
Gordon smiled. That's okay, then. The Postal Service has always carried mostly fantasies, anyway. The boy looked at him puzzled, but Gordon set his cap on his head and said nothing more. Since departing the shards of Minnesota so long ago, Gordon had seen few villages as prosperous and apparently happy as Cottage Grove. The farms now brought in a surplus most years. The militia was well-drilled and, unlike at Oak Ridge, unoppressive. As hope of finding true civilization faded, Gordon had slowly reduced the scope of his dreams until a place like this seemed almost like paradise. It was ironic, then, that the very hoax that had taken him safely this far through the suspicious mountain hamlets now kept him from remaining here. For in order to maintain his illusion, he had to keep moving. They all believed in him. If his illusion failed now, even the good people of this town would certainly turn on him. The walled village covered one corner of pre-war Cottage Grove. Its pub was a large, snug basement with two big fireplaces and a bar where the bitter local homebrew was served in tall clay steins. Mayor Peter Van Cleek sat in a corner booth talking earnestly with Eric Stevens, Johnny's grandfather and newly appointed postmaster of Cottage Grove. The two men were poring over a copy of Gordon's Federal Regulations as he and Johnny stepped into the pub. Back in Oak Ridge, Gordon had run off a few score copies on a hand-cranked mimeograph machine he had managed to get working in the old deserted post office. A lot of thought and care had gone into those circulars. They had to have the flavor of authenticity and at the same time present no obvious threat to local strongmen, giving them no reason to fear Gordon's mythical restored United States, or Gordon himself. So far, those sheets had been his most inspired prop. Tall, gaunt-faced Peter Van Cleek stood and shook Gordon's hand, motioning him to a seat. The bartender hurried over with two tall steins of thick brown beer. It was warm, of course, but delicious, like pumpernickel bread. The mayor waited, puffing nervously on his clay pipe, until Gordon put his stein down with a lip-smacking sigh. Van Cleek nodded at the implied compliment, but his frown remained fixed. He tapped the paper in front of him.
These regulations here aren't very detailed, Mr. Inspector.
Call me Gordon, please. These are informal times.
Ah, yes. Gordon. Please call me Peter.
The mayor was clearly uncomfortable.
Well, Peter,
Gordon nodded.
The restored U.S. government has learned some hard lessons. One has been not to impose rigid standards on far-flung localities who have problems St. Paul City can't even imagine, let alone regulate.
Gordon launched into one of his prepared pitches. There's the question of money, for instance. Most communities dropped pre-war currency soon after the food center riots. Barter systems are the rule, and they usually work just fine, except when debt service turns into a form of slavery.
That much was all true. In his travels, Gordon had seen versions of feudal serfdom rising all over. Money was a joke.
The federal authorities in St. Paul have declared the old currency moot. There are just too many bills and coins out there for sparse rural economies. Still, we're trying to encourage national commerce. One way is by accepting old-time $2 bills to pay postage for letters carried by U.S. mail. They never were very common and are impossible to forge with present-day technology. Pre-1965 silver coins are also acceptable.
We've already taken in over $40 worth,
Johnny Stevens interjected.
Folks are hunting all over for those old bills and coins, and they've started using them to pay off barter debts, too.
Gordon shrugged. It had started already. Sometimes the little things he added to his tale, simply in order to lend verisimilitude, took off by themselves in ways he had never expected. He couldn't see how a little money put back into circulation, given value by a local myth in the restored U.S., could hurt these people much. Van Cleek nodded. He moved on to the next item.
This part here about, no coercion without elections?
He tapped the paper.
Well, we do have sort of regular town meetings, and people from the surrounding hamlets take part when something big is up. But I can't rightly say I or my militia chief were ever really voted for. Not in a real secret ballot like it says here.
He shook his head.
And we've had to do some pretty drastic things, especially during the early days. I hope we're not going to have that held too hard against us, Mr. Gordon. We really have been doing our best. We have a school, for instance. Most of the younger kids attend after harvest, and we can make a start salvaging machines and voting like it says here.
Van Cleek wanted reassurance. He was trying to catch Gordon's eye, but Gordon lifted his beer mug in order not to meet his gaze. One of the major ironies he had found in his travels had been this phenomenon, that those who had fallen the least far into savagery were those who seemed the most ashamed of having fallen at all. He coughed, clearing his throat.
It seems to me you've been doing a pretty good job here, Peter. The past doesn't matter as much as the future, anyway. I don't think you have to worry about the federal government interfering at all.
Van Cleek looked relieved. Gordon was sure there would be a secret ballot election here within weeks, and the people of this area would deserve what they got if they elected anyone as their leader but this gruff, sensible man.
One thing bothers me.
It was Eric Stevens who spoke. The spry oldster had been Gordon's obvious choice as postmaster. For one thing, he ran the local trading post and was the best-educated man in town, with a pre-war college degree. Another reason was that Stevens had appeared the most suspicious when Gordon rode into town several days before, proclaiming a new era for Oregon under the restored U.S. Appointing him postmaster seemed to persuade him to believe, if only for his own prestige and profit. Only incidentally, he would also probably do a good job, as long as the myth lasted, at least. Old Stevens turned his beer stein on the table, leaving a broad oval ring.
What I can't figure out is why nobody's been out here from St. Paul City before. Sure, I know you had to cross a hell of a lot of wild country to get here. Almost all of it on foot, you say. But what I want to know is, why didn't they just send somebody out in an airplane?
There was a brief silence at the table. Gordon could tell that townsmen nearby were listening in as well.
Ah, Gramps!
Johnny Stevens shook his head in embarrassment for his grandfather.
Don't you realize how bad the war was? All the airplanes and complicated machines were wrecked by that pulse thing that blasted all the radios and such right at the beginning of the war. Then later on, there wouldn't have been anybody around who knew how to fix them, and there'd be no spare parts.
Gordon blinked in brief surprise. The kid was good. He had been born after the fall of industrial civilization, yet he had a grasp of the essentials. Of course, everyone knew about the electromagnetic pulses from giant H-bombs exploded high in space that had devastated electronic devices all over the world on that deadly first day. But Johnny's understanding went beyond that to the interdependence of a machine culture. Still, if the kid was bright, he must have gotten it from his grandfather. The older Stevens looked at Gordon archly.
That right, Inspector? No spares or mechanics left?
Gordon knew that explanation wouldn't hold under close scrutiny. He blessed those long, tedious hours on broken roads since leaving Oak Ridge when he had worked out his story in detail.
No, not quite.
The pulse radiation, the blast, and the fallout destroyed a lot. The bugs and riots in the 3-year winter killed many skilled people, but actually, it didn't take long to get some machines going again. There were airplanes ready to fly within days. The restored U.S. has scores of them, repaired and tested and waiting to fly. But they can't take off. They're all grounded and will be for years to come. The old man looked puzzled.
Why is that, Inspector?
For the same reason you wouldn't pick up a broadcast even if you put together a working radio, Gordon said. He paused for effect. Because of laser satellites. Peter von Kleek slapped the table.
Son of a bitch!
All over the room, heads turned their way. Eric Stevens sighed, giving Gordon a look that had to be total acceptance, or admiration of a better liar than himself.
Well, what's a laser sat?
Johnny's grandfather explained. We won the war. He snorted at the famous marginal victory that had been trumpeted in the weeks before the riots began.
But the enemy must have left some sleeper satellites in orbit.
Program them to wait a few months or years, then anything so much as lets out a peep over the radio or tries to fly and zap! He sliced the air decisively.
Huh. No wonder I never picked up anything on my crystal set.
Gordon nodded. The story fit so well, it could even be true. He actually hoped so, for it might explain the silence and the lonely emptiness of the sky without the world having to be totally vacant of civilization. And how else to explain the slag heaps that remained of so many radio antennas he had passed in his travels?
What's the government doing about it?
Von Kleek asked earnestly. Fairy tales, Gordon thought. His lies would grow more complex as he traveled until at last someone caught him up.
There are some scientists left. We hope to find facilities in California for making and launching orbital rockets.
He left the implication hanging. The others looked disappointed.
If only there was a way to take out the damned satellites sooner,
the mayor said.
Think of all those aircraft just sitting there. Can you imagine how surprised the next Holiness raiding party out of the damned Rogue River would be to find us farmers backed up by the U.S. Air Force and some bloody A-10s?
He gave a whooshing sound and made diving motions with his hands. Then the mayor did a pretty good imitation of a machine gun. Gordon laughed with the others. Like boys, they lived briefly in a fantasy of rescue and power to the good guys. Other men and women gathered around, now that the mayor and the postal inspector had apparently finished their business. Someone pulled out a harmonica. A guitar was passed to Johnny Stevens, who proved to be quite gifted. Soon the crowd was singing bawdy folk songs and old commercial jingles. The mood was high. Hope was thick as the warm, dark beer, and tasted at least as good. It was later in the evening that he heard it for the first time. On his way out of the men's room, grateful that Cottage Grove had somehow retained gravity flow indoor plumbing, Gordon stopped suddenly near the back stairs. There had been a sound. The crowd by the fireplace was singing, "Gather round and listen to my tale, a tale of a fateful trip." Gordon cocked his head. Had he imagined the other murmur? It had been faint, and his head was ringing a bit on its own from the beer. But a queer feeling at the back of his neck, an intuition, refused to let go. It made him turn around and begin climbing the stairs, a steep flight rising into the building above the basement pub. The narrow passage was dimly lit by a candle at the halfway landing. The happy, drunken sounds of the songfest faded away behind him as he ascended slowly, careful of the creaking steps. At the top, he emerged into a darkling hallway. Gordon listened fruitlessly for what felt like a long time. After some moments, he turned around, writing it all off to an overworked imagination. Then it came again. A series of faint, eerie sounds at the very edge of audibility. The half-memories they pulled forth sent a shiver up Gordon's back. He had not heard their like since long, long ago. At the end of the dusty hallway, faint light outlined a cracked door jamb. He approached, quietly.
Bloop!
Gordon touched the cold metal knob. It was free of dust. Someone was already inside.
Wah! Wah!
The absent weight of his revolver, left in his guest room in supposedly safe Cottage Grove, made him feel half-naked as he turned the knob and opened the door. Dusty tarpaulins covered stacked crates filled with odds and ends, everything from salvaged tires to tools to furniture, a hoard put aside by the villagers against the uncertain future. Around one row of boxes came the source of that faint, flickering light. There were hushed voices just ahead, whispering in urgent excitement. And that sound.
Bloop! Bloop!
Gordon crept alongside the towers of musty crates, like unsteady cliffs of ancient sediment, growing more tense as he approached the end of the row. The glow spread. It was a cold light, without heat. A floorboard creaked under his foot. Five faces turned up suddenly, cast into deep relief by the strange light. In a breathless instant, Gordon saw that they were children, staring up at him in terrified awe, the more so because they clearly recognized him. Their eyes were wide, and they did not move. But Gordon cared about none of that, only about a little, box-like object that lay on an oval rug in the center of the small coven. He could not believe what he was seeing. Across its bottom was a row of tiny buttons, and in the center, a flat, gray screen gave off a pearly sheen. Pink spiders emerged from flying saucers and stepped imperiously down the screen to a crunching, marching beat. Arriving at the bottom without opposition, they bleated in triumph, then their ranks reformed and the assault began all over again. Gordon's throat was dry.
Where?
He breathed. The children stood up. One of the boys swallowed.
Sir?
Gordon pointed.
Where in the name of all that's holy did you get that?
He shook his head.
More important, where did you get the batteries?
One of the children began to cry.
Please, sir, we didn't know it was wrong. Timmy Smith told us it's just the game the old-time children used to have. We find them all over, only they don't work no more.
Who? Gordon insisted. It's Timmy Smith.
A boy. His pa's come down from Cresswell with a wagon to trade the last couple years. Timmy swapped this one for 20 old ones we found that wouldn't work no more.
Gordon recalled the map he had been studying in his room earlier in the evening. Cresswell was just a little north of here, not far off the route he had planned to take to Eugene.
Can it be?
Hope was too hot and sudden to be a pleasure, or even recognized.
Did Timmy Smith say where he got the toy?
He tried not to spook the children, but some of his urgency must have spilled over, frightening them. A girl wailed.
He said he got it from Cyclops!
Then, in a panicked flurry, the children were gone, disappeared down little alleys in the dusty storage room. Gordon was left suddenly alone, standing quite still, watching tiny invaders descend in the glow of the little gray screen.
Crunch, crunch, crunch,
they marched. The game
looped
victoriously, then began to play all over again. 3. Eugene. The pony's breath puffed visibly as it plodded on through the dank drizzle, led by a man in a rain-slick poncho. Its only burdens were a saddle and two thick bags, plastic-covered against the damp. The gray interstate glistened wetly. Deep puddles lay like small lakes in the concrete. Dirt had blown over the four-lane highway during the post-war drought years, and grass had later begun to grow as the old northwest rains returned. Much of the highway was now a ribbon of meadow, a flat notch in the forested hills overlooking a churning river. Gordon raised his slicker tent-like to consult his map. Ahead, to his right, a large fen had formed where the south and east forks of the Willamette came together before cutting west between Eugene and Springfield. According to the old map, there was a modern industrial park below. Now, only a few old roofs stuck out above the mire. The neat lanes, parking lots, and lawns were a realm for waterfowl, who seemed not at all discomforted by the wet. Back in Cresswell, they had told Gordon the interstate would be impassable a little north of here. He would have to cut through Eugene itself, find an open bridge across the river, and then somehow get back onto the highway to Cobourg. The Cresswellers had been a little vague on details. Few travelers had made the trip since the war.
That's all right. Eugene has been one of my goals for months. We'll take a look at what's become of her.
Briefly, though, now the city was only a milestone along his path toward a deeper mystery, waiting farther to the north. The elements had not yet defeated the interstate. It might be grassy and puddled, but the only fallen bridges he had passed still bore obvious signs of violence. When man built well, it seemed, only time or man himself could bring his things down.
And they did build well, Gordon thought.
Maybe future generations of Americans, ambling through the forests, eating each other, would think these works the creations of gods. He shook his head.
The rain. It's got me in a fey mood.
Soon he came upon a large sign, half buried in a puddle. Gordon kicked away debris and knelt to examine the rusting plate, like a tracker reading a cold trail in a forest path.
30th Avenue, he read aloud.
A broad road cut into the hills to the west, away from the interstate. According to the map, downtown Eugene was just over the forested rise that way. He got up and patted his pack animal.
Come on, Dobbin. Swish your tail and signal for a right turn. It's off the freeway and down surface streets from here.
The horse puffed stoically as Gordon gave the reins a gentle tug and let it down the off-ramp, then under the overpass and on up the slope to the west. From the top of the hill, a gently falling mist seemed somehow to soften the ruined town's disfigurement. Rains had long since washed away the fire stains. Slow beards of climbing greenery, sprouting from cracks in the pavement, covered many of the buildings, hiding their wounds. Folks in Cresswell had warned him what to expect. Still, it was never easy coming into a dead city. Gordon descended to the ghostly streets, strewn with broken glass. The rain-wet pavement sparkled with another era's shattered panes. In the lower parts of town, alders grew in the streets, in dirt laid down when a river of mud slammed into the city from the broken Fall Creek and Lookout Point dams. The collapse of those reservoirs had wiped out Route 58 west of Oak Ridge, forcing Gordon to make his long detour south and west through Curtin, Cottage Grove, and Cresswell before finally swinging north again. The devastation was pretty bad.
And yet, they held on here. From all accounts, they almost made it.
Back in Cresswell, between all the meetings and celebrations, the election of the new postmaster and excited plans to extend the new mail delivery network east and west, the citizens had regaled Gordon with stories of the valiant struggle of Eugene. They told how the city had struggled to hold out for 4 long years after war and epidemic had isolated it from the outer world. In a strange alliance of the university community and redneck country farmers, somehow the city-state had overcome all threats, until at last the bandit gangs finished her off by blasting the upland reservoirs all at once, cutting off both power and unpolluted water. The tale was already legendary, almost like the fall of Troy. And yet the storytellers hadn't sounded forlorn in telling it. It was more as if they now looked upon the disaster as a temporary setback, to be overcome within their own lifetimes. For Cresswell had been in a tizzy of optimism even before Gordon's arrival. His tale of a restored United States was the town's second dose of good news in less than 3 months. Last winter, another visitor had arrived. This one from the north, a grinning man in a white and black robe, who passed out startling gifts for the children and then departed, speaking the magical name Cyclops. Cyclops, the stranger had said. Cyclops would make things right again. Cyclops would bring comfort and progress back into the world, redeeming everybody from drudgery and lingering hopelessness, the legacy of the Doom War. All the people had to do was collect their old machinery, particularly electronics. Cyclops would take their donations of useless, ruined equipment, plus perhaps a little surplus food to maintain its volunteer servants. In return, Cyclops would give the Cresswellans things that worked. The toys were only tokens of what was to come. Someday, there would be real miracles. Gordon had been unable to get anything coherent from the people of Cresswell. They were too deliriously happy to be completely logical. Half of them assumed his restored United States was behind Cyclops, and half thought it was the other way around. It hardly occurred to anybody that the two wonders could be unconnected, two spreading legends encountering one another in the wilderness. Gordon didn't dare disabuse them or ask too many questions. He had left as quickly as he could, loaded down with more letters than ever, determined to follow the tale to its source. It was about noon as he turned north on University Street. The gentle rain was no bother. He could explore Eugene for a while and still make it by nightfall to Coburg, where a settlement of gleaners supposedly lived. Somewhere north of there lay the territory from which the followers of Cyclops were spreading word of their strange redemption. As he walked quietly past the gutted buildings, Gordon wondered if he should even try to pull his postman hoax in the north. He remembered the little spiders and saucers flashing in the darkness and found it hard not to hope. Perhaps he could give up the scam and find something real to believe in at last. Perhaps someone at last was leading a fight against the Dark Age. It was too sweet a glimmer to let go of, but too delicate to hold tightly. The shattered storefronts of the deserted town gave way at last to 18th Avenue and the University of Oregon campus, the broad athletic field now overgrown with aspen and alder saplings, some more than 20 feet high. There, near the old gymnasium, Gordon slowed down, then stopped abruptly and held the pony still. The animal snorted and pawed the ground as Gordon listened, and then was sure. Somewhere, perhaps not too far away, somebody was screaming. The faint crying crescendoed, then fell away. It was a woman's voice, soaked with pain and deadly fear. Gordon pushed back the cover of his holster and drew his revolver. Had it come from the north? The east? He pushed into a semi-jungle between the university buildings, hurriedly seeking a place to go to ground. He had had an easy time of it since leaving Oak Ridge months ago. Too easy. Obviously, he had acquired bad habits. It was a miracle no one had heard him traipsing down these deserted streets as if he owned them. He led the pony through a gaping door in the side of a slate-sided gymnasium and tethered the animal behind a fold-down stand of bleachers. Gordon dropped a pile of oats near the animal, but left the saddle in place and cinched. Now what? Do we wait it out? Or do we check it out? Gordon unwrapped his bow and quiver and set the string. In the rain, they were probably more reliable, and certainly quieter than his carbine or revolver. He stuffed one of the bulging mail sacks into a ventilation shaft, well out of sight. As he was searching for a place to hide the other, he suddenly realized what he was doing. He grinned ironically at his momentary foolishness and left the second bag lying on the floor as he set off to find the trouble. The sounds came from a brick building just ahead, one whose long bank of glass windows still gleamed. Apparently, looters hadn't even thought the place worth bothering with. Now Gordon could hear faint, muttered voices, the soft nickering of horses, and the creaking of tack. Seeing no watchers at the roofs or windows, he dashed across the overgrown lawn and up a broad flight of concrete steps, flattening against a doorway around the corner of the building. He breathed open-mouthed for silence. The door bore an ancient, rusted padlock and an engraved plastic sign. Theodore Sturgeon Memorial Center, dedicated May 1989. Cafeteria hours, 11 to 2:30, 5 to 8 p.m. The voices came from just within, though too muffled to make out anything distinct. An outside stairway led up to several floors overhead. He stepped back and saw that a door lay ajar 3 flights up. Gordon knew he was being a fool once again. Now that he had the trouble located, he really should go collect his pony and get the hell out of there as quickly as possible. The voices within grew angry. Through the crack in the door, he heard a blow being struck. A woman's cry of pain was followed by coarse male laughter. Sighing softly at the flaw in his character that kept him there, instead of running away as anyone with any brains would do, Gordon started climbing the concrete stair, careful not to make a sound. Rot and mold covered an area just within the half-open doorway, but beyond that, the fourth floor of the student center looked untouched. Miraculously, none of the glass panes in the great skylight had been smashed, though the copper frame wore a patina of verdigris. Under the atrium's pale glow, a carpeted ramp spiraled downward, connecting each floor. As Gordon cautiously approached the open center of the building, it felt momentarily as if he had stepped backward in time. Looters had left the student organization offices, with their passionate tornadoes of paper, completely untouched. Bulletin boards were still plastered with age-dimmed announcements of sporting events, variety shows, political rallies. Only at the far end were there a few notices in bright red having to do with the emergency, the final crisis that had struck almost without warning, bringing it all to an end. Otherwise, the clutter was homey, radical, enthusiastic. Young. Gordon hurried past and skirted down the spiraling ramp toward the voices below. A second-floor balcony extended out over the main lobby. He got down on his hands and knees and crawled the rest of the way. On the north side of the building, to the right, part of the two-story glass facing had been shattered to make room for a pair of large wagons. Steam rose from 6 horses tethered over by the west wall behind the row of dark pinball machines. Outside, amid the broken glass shards, the sulking rain created spreading pink pools around 4 sprawled bodies recently cut down by automatic weapons fire. Only one of the victims had even managed to draw a sidearm during the ambush. His pistol lay in a puddle, inches from a motionless hand. The voices came from his left, where the balcony made a turn. Gordon crawled cautiously forward and looked out over the other part of the L-shaped room. Several ceiling-high mirrors remained along the west wall, giving Gordon a wide view of the floor below. A blaze of smashed furniture crackled in a large fireplace between the reflecting panes. He hugged the moldy carpet and lifted his head just enough to see 4 heavily armed men arguing by the fire. A 5th lounged on a couch over to the left, his automatic rifle aimed idly at a pair of prisoners. A boy of about 9 years, and a young woman. Red wheels on her face matched the pattern of a man's hand. Her brown hair was matted, and she held the boy close, watching her captors warily. Neither prisoner seemed to have any energy left for tears. The bearded men were all garbed in one-piece, pre-war army surplus outfits, in green, brown, and gray speckled camouflage. Each wore one or more gold earrings in his left earlobe. Survivalists. Gordon felt a wave of revulsion. Once upon a time, before the war, the word had had several meanings, ranging from common sense, community-conscious preparedness, all the way to antisocial, paranoid gun nuts. By one way of looking at things, perhaps Gordon himself could be called a survivalist. But it was the latter connotation that had stuck, after the ruin the worst sort had caused. Everywhere he had gone in his travels, folk shared this reaction. More than the enemy, whose bombs and germs had wrought such destruction during the one-week war, the people in nearly every wrecked county and hamlet blamed these macho outlaws for the terrible troubles that led to the final fall. And worst of all had been the followers of Nathan Hone. May he rot in hell. But there weren't supposed to be any survivalists anymore in the Valley of the Willamette. In Cottage Grove, Gordon had been told that the last big bunch had been driven south of Roseburg years ago, into the wilderness of the Rogue River country. What were these devils doing here, then? He moved a little closer and listened.
I don't know, Strike Leader. I don't think we ought to go any deeper on this recon. We've already had enough surprises with this Cyclops thing the bird here let slip about before she clammed up. I say we ought to head back to the boats at Site Bravo and report what we found.
The speaker was a short, bald man with a wiry frame. He warmed his hands over the fire, his back to Gordon. A saw, assault gun equipped with a flash suppressor, was slung muzzle down over his back. The big man he addressed as Strike Leader wore a scar from one ear to his chin, only partly hidden by a gray-flecked black beard. He grinned, displaying several gaps in his teeth.
You don't really believe that bull the broad was spewing, do you? All that crap about a big computer that talks? What a crock. He's just feeding it to us to give us a stall.
Oh, yeah? Well, how do you explain all that?
The little man gestured back to the wagons. In the mirror, Gordon could see a corner of the nearest. It was loaded down with odds and ends, no doubt collected here on the university campus. The hall seemed to consist mostly of electronic equipment. Not farm tools, not clothes or jewelry, but electronics. It was the first time Gordon had ever seen a gleaner's wagon filled with salvage like this. The implication caused Gordon's pulse to pound in his ears. In his excitement, he barely ducked down in time as the little man turned to pick up something from a nearby table.
And what about this?
The small survivalist asked. In his hand was a toy, a small video game like the one Gordon had seen in Cottage Grove. Lights flashed and the little box gave out a high, cheerful melody. The strike leader stared at it for a long moment. Finally, he shrugged.
Don't mean shit.
One of the other raiders spoke.
I agree with Little Jim. That's Blue Five, the big man growled. Maintain discipline.
Right, the third man nodded, apparently unperturbed by the rebuke.
I agree with Blue Five, then. I think we ought to report this to Colonel Bezor and the General. It could affect the invasion. What if the farmers do got high-tech up north of here? We could wind up doing an end run right into some heavy-duty lasers or something. Especially if they got some old Air Force or Navy stuff working again.
All the more reason to continue this recon, the leader growled. We've got to find out more about this Cyclops thing.
But you saw how hard we had to work to get the woman to tell us even what we learned. And we can't leave her here while we go deeper on recon. If we turn back, we could put her on one of the boats and...
Off the damn woman! We finish with her tonight. The boy, too. You've been in the mountains too long, Blue Four. These valleys are crawling with pretty birds. We can't risk this one making noise, and we sure can't take her along on a recon.
The argument didn't surprise Gordon. All over the country, wherever they had managed to establish themselves, these post-war crazies had taken to raiding for women, as well as for food and slaves. After the first few years of slaughter, most Holenist enclaves had found themselves with incredibly high male-female ratios. Now,
women were valuable chattel in the loose, macho, hyper-survivalist societies.